Robert Ladd is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ladd to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. The Execution Watch for Robert Ladd begins.
Good evening. My name is Ray Hill. The name of the show is Execution Watch. We only do this show when Texas kills someone on death row. We have done two other shows. We did one show for an execution in Virginia, and we did one show for an execution in Georgia. But tonight it's Texas again in all too frequency. Hello, Pat. Where are you?
I'm standing in front of the Walls Unit, which is the Texas Death House, with nearly 50 other people tonight waiting for the witnesses to walk across for Mr. Ladd.
There has not been a crossing of the road yet. Pat?
I'm sorry, you're cutting out, Ray.
Okay, there has not been a crossing of the road yet?
No, there has not. It has just been announced that the Supreme Court has denied Mr. Ladd, so I'm sure they're going to cross in just a second.
Okay, tell us what is your understanding of how that works. All of the appeals have been exhausted, and the witnesses start crossing the road when the procedure is for sure to continue. Is that correct?
Yes, the witnesses are held in a small building across this small private street. And once the court rules by denying the defendant, the witnesses will walk across. We understand that there are two witnesses that are pen pals of Mr. Ladd that are going to witness for him.
Any family that you know of?
No, unfortunately, it's not.
Okay. How many folks are there?
We have nearly 50 people here tonight. We have people from Europe and the U.S. We have religious groups. We have activist groups. We have some students that just walked down and that are against the death penalty and wanted to stand with us.
Okay. Is there any unique or different people there that you can identify?
Well, I know that there's family members of at least five death row prisoners that I can see right now.
Is that a usual situation, Pat, at the death house demonstration for people who are have relatives in line awaiting their turn come to these events?
Well, we have a few every week that do come, but this time, because of the visiting schedules, they all came tonight. It's really nice and encouraging to see them. As we all know, the death row guys have formed a family. And these women support all of the death row guys, not just their particular spouse. They come out here.
I know we got into the discussion of the camaraderie on the row between the various inmates in a couple of recent execution watches where we had interviews with people on there. But there is a further bonding of the families as well as the inmates.
Yes, there is, because they know that they have been thrown into a situation beyond their control, and not too many people in the outside world understand them. They get ostracized from all around, and sometimes from their own family. So the closeness that they feel with each other is very special to them.
So when you say witnesses cross the road, there are two groups, actually. There's a group of media, and then there's a group of witnesses that are appearing on behalf of the person being executed.
Yes, the victim's family is already in, and then the media will come across, and then whoever is witnessing for Mr. Ladd will come across. And we know the execution is over when the media comes out.
And so far nothing has happened tonight.
No, they haven't crossed yet.
Okay, now, have we dealt with a situation where there's been kind of an upfront delay before that you know of?
Well, depending on what the court, yes, we've dealt with a delay. We stayed here one night with Dwayne Buck until about 10 o'clock at night. But from my understanding, the Supreme Court has already ruled, has already denied. So I don't understand why the witnesses have not crossed.
Well, it seemed like I recall one situation they had some difficulty finding a vein, and there was some delay. And they don't bring the witnesses in until the person in the death chamber is wired up.
Exactly, exactly. And after the fiasco in Oklahoma, I don't think that Texas wants to repeat that fiasco. And so, yeah, that is true. When the witnesses go in, Mr. Ladd will have the IVs running in both arms, and he will be covered up with a sheet up to his chest.
And you said that there were people, vigilance at the death house from Europe. How do you know that?
They know me, and they come up and introduce themselves to me.
Oh, so the activist community is interneted, right?
The activist community is very interneted.
Okay. Go ahead.
We run several Facebook pages, as everyone knows, and anything on my page is open. It's all geared to the abolition of the death penalty.
Pat, I appreciate you sharing all that information with me. I was hoping that we would. I don't want those witnesses to cross the road.
I don't either. I want them all to go home. I want all the death row prisoners to be taken off of death row and either put in general population or sent home, because we know there are innocent people on death row.
If Grazik goes on to escape, tell him I'll buy him a cup of coffee next time I see him.
I will. I'll call back as soon as they cross.
Yeah, just call Elizabeth and let her know. But thank you very much for this conversation.
Okay, thank you, sir.
And that was Pat Hartwell. And Pat Hartwell is an activist in her own right, and she is in Huntsville in front of the death chamber. We have an offsite reporter there. We have another offsite reporter at a demonstration here in Houston, and I understand that demonstration is gathered up over on West Alabama at Woodhead in front of St. Stephen's Church. And as soon as Dave Atwood gets a call in, we're going to put him on the air and chat with him. But the deal is that we usually cover one Houston demonstration, and sometimes we've gone as far as cover them down in the valley, because there are demonstrations all over the state when executions happen. And the point of Execution Watch is to show you there are a good many Texans who care enough about this issue to get out and put some shoe leather on the sidewalk wherever it is convenient for them to do that. And Pat, on her own nickel, goes to Huntsville every year. Now, death row itself is in Livingston, and Elizabeth and Mark Pirtle and I will be there next Wednesday to interview two inmates, Lester Bowers and maybe Rodney Reed. And so we're going to be there to interview them next week because they want to be interviewed for this show when and if we do an Execution Watch show. Also in queue is Pruitt. And bless Pruitt's heart, I am convinced that Pruitt was falsely charged of killing a guard in a Texas prison. And I'm convinced that the people that really killed that guard were other guards. But they're going to execute Pruitt for that. We think. We hope not, but we think. So I'm going to go to Jim. Jim? What in the world happened in this case? This is not a pretty case.
This is not a pretty case, and it's also tried in a place where people are real cranky. It's tried in Tyler, Texas, and they're real cranky up there. What happened, Mr. Ladd, was on from Dallas. He paroled out on a triple murder that occurred in Dallas. Surprisingly enough, he only got 40 years out of that. Paroled out to Tyler. When he paroled out, he was working. There was an agency up there called the Andrea House, where they will take in people with drug problems and take in people who are mentally handicapped and let them do performance work and pay them a salary. And while he was there, he met a lady by the name of Vicki Ann Gardner, who had been brain damage at birth, was mildly retarded, mentally handicapped. But she was able to do real well, had her own apartment, was living by herself. And what happened, he went to her apartment, killed her, strangled her with part of an ignition cord by, and sexually assaulted her, and then set her body on fire. Really, what he did, he set the pubic area of the body on fire to try to hide the fact he sexually assaulted her. Then he ransacked the apartment, got a bunch of her jewelry, got a DVR, a DVD, he got a mobile telephone. Then he goes over to a crack dealer's house and changes the VCR that she just bought for $520 crack pieces of crack cocaine. And also she bought the telephone with him and hocked it and gave it to the crack dealer. And the next morning he shows up with some more of her electrical appliances and sells them back to the crack dealer and gets more rock cocaine. What happened? The crack dealer in turn sends it to a pawn shop. The pawn shop discovers it's stolen. They notify the police and they track everybody down, and that's how they find him. And the evidence that tied him to the crime, number one, his palm print was found inside the house. They managed to get some DNA samples out of the lady's vagina, and it matched up with him.
Well, did he have a relationship, something going on with this woman?
Nothing other than the fact he just had worked with her. There was nothing going on.
In other words, normally he would not have needed to be in her apartment.
No. And as a matter of fact, he'd been fired prior to this even happening. He had been working at this place and at the Andrew House, and they fired him because he wouldn't show up and was insubordinate and pretty mean to people. And so what happened, they fired him, so he wasn't even working there at the time of the crime. And like I say, what linked him up to it was a... And then when they arrested him, they found a bunch of her costume jewelry on his person. It took the jury 20 minutes to convict him of capital murder. It then took the jury 18 minutes to give him the death penalty.
They don't mess around in Smith County.
That's what I said. They're cranky people in Tyler.
Yeah, well, you know, I recall my friend Carrie Max Cook was convicted in Tyler, Texas. And Carrie didn't know anything about that murder. He's since been exonerated. He didn't have a hint about who killed Mary Jo. They tried him for being gay.
Yeah, they just got, well, there's a lot of cases.
He was convicted of that, but that has an additional handle of being in a murder charge.
Right.
And he wound up being ultimately exonerated. I think we've got Dave. Dave.
Hello.
Where are you?
This is Dave.
Where are you?
I am out by St. Stephen's Church on West Alabama.
On West Alabama and Woodhead.
In Woodhead, correct.
How many vigilants have you?
We only got about 5 people here today. Okay. Not a very big group.
Well, it's...
But we're here with all our signs and banners, so... We have good visibility, even though there's not a large crowd.
And tell the folks about the organization with whom you work.
Okay, I'm with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We're a statewide organization, and we have groups throughout the state of Texas. We are for total abolition of the death penalty. We do a lot of education work. We work with the legislature, and we do protests and vigils and different things like that. So we've been in existence for really, I think, 20 years now, officially. So we're throughout the state of Texas. We're going to have a big conference coming up in February. And if they go to our website, which is tcadp.org, they can find information on all the various activities, including the conference in February.
All right. I understand from Pat that they've got between 40 and 50 people in Huntsville, several European beings, and the families of other people awaiting their turn on death row. Do you find something significant in that?
Well, I think, you know, it shows growing interest in the subject matter, and if people will come out, they can, you know, and protest the execution of somebody who's not a family member, then they will certainly get support if their time comes up. So I think it's a wonderful thing that they come out, even though it's not somebody directly in their family.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much. Give my regards to the other vigilants.
We've got a guy from Iran with us today, which is interesting.
Wonderful. When I last talked to Pat, the witnesses had not yet crossed the road, but it seemed imminent as the state of the cases that they would.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Ray.
Good night,
take
Dave.
Care. Bye-bye.
That was Dave Atwood of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and the acronym of that, plus.org, is their website. Hey, Susan.
Okay, well, at the punishment phase of the trial, the state had put on evidence of the previous triple murder that occurred in 78 that he pled guilty to in 1980, and when he pled guilty, he received a sentence of 40 years on the murder of the woman.
Unlike some of the cases we hear about, these murders were actually litigated.
He pled guilty to them. Litigated to me means have a trial. If you mean adjudicated, they were adjudicated.
They were,
yes,
adjudicated. But that's not necessary in the punishment phase.
No, but In this particular case, he pled guilty to murder of the woman and her two children. So that was three murders that they gave him. He pled guilty and received 40 on each one of the murders, 20 on the arson, the fire that was set ostensibly to cover up the murders, and 10 on the theft, whatever was taken, you know, in the incident. He pled to all these charges in 1980. He did 16 years in prison, and then he paroled out. So he was actually on parole when the killing of Vicki Gardner happened.
He was still on parole for previous homicide.
And there was also psychiatric evidence that he had antisocial personality disorder, that disorder was permanent, and that he was inherently violent, and that he had little regard for other people's welfare.
Now, the defense would not have presented the inherently violent.
No, that was brought up. The state did that. Of course, of course.
Okay.
I mean.
Oh, by the way, I had to inform the audience that our crack producer, Elizabeth Stein, has informed me that there's been some walking going on in Huntsville. The witnesses have crossed the road, and that means the procedure has begun and will continue until Robert Ladd is dead.
Of course, you know, obviously the jury knew the nature of the case. You know, you had the previous triple murder and the psychiatric evidence. And so, of course, the jury would come back on the issue of future dangerousness. You know, of course, the finding would be against him there.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things about these homicides that come to mind. I mean, if you're going to kill somebody, I think the last thing you should do is build a fire there, because it means that the fire department will be there quickly and find the body ahead of schedule. That's one thing. The other thing is, if you're going to commit murder suicide, do the suicide part first. That seems to be that would make a lot more sense to me. If you're going to do murder suicide, do the suicide part first and see how that works out, and then
you can't do the murder.
Oh, see, that's a sneak route.
Okay.
But setting fire to a body or a place where you have committed a murder, don't people realize that smoke attracts fire wagons? And pretty quickly?
I mean, the 1978, shall we say, case, it certainly, the arson did not, you know, in any way.
I don't think it ever destroys evidence.
Well, it may sometimes, but clearly in 1978, it didn't change the, you know, the outcome that, you know, of what happened, mm-hmm. that he was, you know, obviously he was prosecuted, he pled guilty, but he did the same thing again.
Well, could that be introduced as evidence that he was retarded because he's not too smart to set the fire if it didn't help?
Well, that was one of his later claims. I don't know if somebody else is going to take that up, but that was one of his later claims afterwards. The only thing is, apparently there was some, you know, he accomplished certain things. He got to be a licensed barber. He managed to, I think, get a GED in prison. And at one time, he did get a higher IQ test, higher than the level of retarded, which was apparently 87, when he had picked up the cases that were from the 1978 killing. So, and then there was other evidence that he was functional in terms of employment, and he was working at the victim, and he both worked at this center that apparently was a center for mentally challenged people.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get a jack with this stuff. Who's it going to cover the...
mentioned about the fires, right?
Yeah.
It worked the other way. The problem is this case, he set the pubic area on fire. My mother-in-law over here is yelling and waving his hands. When he gets here, I'll finish. What happened, they set the pubic area on fire under the idea of trying to hide the fact he sexually assaulted the women, which doesn't show that. It works the other way. It works, cuts two ways. He's smart enough to figure out that might destroy evidence of any sexual assault.
I read in one of the reports that there was a whole lot of smoke, but not much fire.
Not much fire at all. Well, he just set the pubic area on fire with some bedding. He put bedding between their legs and set it on fire.
And that would create a lot of smoke.
Right. And it created money. In fact, the fire department didn't show up till the next morning. This happened on 8 or 9 at night. Okay, and
Well, the homicides that I've worked on, they set fire to the apartment right after the killing. Right, the fire department was there, Johnny on the spot.
This was specific area that they set on fire. And they used that to show that he was clever enough to hide his crime. It didn't work, saying the other way that he showed mental retardation, showed just the opposite.
What's the next piece we got?
Larry, we're going to talk about some of the issues at trial. Do you and Jack, you want to talk about the current issues? Let's talk about the current issues.
The current issues right now that we've got that the Supreme Court turned, I'm not sure if the Supreme Court turned down or if they had.
That's what Pat said, and she's got somebody tries to
right.
that.
There are basically two issues. The first is an Adkins issue. Adkins v. Virginia is a 2002 case that where the Supreme Court basically said, look, if you're mentally retarded, we can't execute you under the idea that it's cruel and unusual punishment. What Adkins breaks it down to is you have to have the consideration for whether somebody is mentally retarded or not is going to center around whether they have adaptive skills and you can also bring up evidence of how they used to hide the crime with the idea that, well, they were smart enough to figure out that, hey, I committed a crime, I killed somebody, how do I hide it?
And that only applies in case of mentally retarded people if you're just bug nuts crazy.
That's correct.
You can still be executed.
Yeah, that is
And we
correct.
Got one of those in the line. We got Panetti coming back up, and Panetti's just crazy.
He's pretty nutty.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it when we cover that case.
So in this case, Ladd had been tested when he first went to TYC at the age of 13, and he tested at 67. His IQ tested at 67. Later on, much later on, his IQ was also tested at 87, and there was another instance where his IQ had been tested at 60, but both the prosecutor and the state and the defense threw away that score, saying that, well, he basically was dragging his feet on the IQ test, and that's why he didn't do so. That's why he tested poorly.
Did he get a GED somewhere in there?
While he was in prison, he got a GED. He went to barber school and apparently passed his barber school on the first try. Looking back at the record, the instructor for the barber school at prison said, I'm looking at the record, and he apparently was one of my better students. Once he got out, he worked one of the jobs that he worked at. He was actually trained and operated an ultrasonic welder, a forklift. An ultrasonic welder is a welder that doesn't create a lot of heat. He operated a forklift. You know, these are not things that you let people who are mentally retarded, who don't have sufficient life skills
adaptive skills
to operate. You just don't let people like that do things like that. The second issue here in Adkins is that he tried to hide the crime. He tried to hide the crime on multiple occasions. It's not that he committed one murder. He committed several murders. And in each instance, he actually tried to hide the crime by setting a fire. And so the idea is that, well, this is, to a certain extent, his MO, and to another extent, that he knows enough to do something to try to hide what he
did. And that would be used as evidence of adaptive skills.
Yes.
This guy is not just retarded. He knows enough to cover his trail.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Jack Lee, practicing defense lawyer in Houston, thank you very much for that report. And here comes Larry. Larry, what's your piece of the puzzle?
Ray, I'm just going to talk for a few minutes about the jury selection process.
Voir
dire. Exactly.
Yeah, how do you pronounce it? Voir dire?
I pronounce it voir dire. Okay, but some people pronounce it as much as voir dire.
Yeah, but in your voice, everything sounds good.
But I think it may be probably voir dire.
Voir dire.
The appellate lawyers and the writ lawyers, when they do their job, they look at what happened at trial. And clearly for death penalty cases, the voir dire is a long process. And the possibility of something going wrong there is pretty great. So they have to look through that process considerably to try to see if they can save the person's life. Now, in a non-death penalty case, the jury selection process takes about a day. They send over about maybe 60 people, and it's done examining the entire panel. And the judge and the prosecutor and the defense lawyers examine the panel. Certain people are eliminated for cause. Others, strikes or peremptory challenges by both the state and the defense lawyers. They each get 10 strikes. And then the first 12 people remaining becomes a jury. The death penalty in capital cases, in contrast, takes a lot longer. First of all, it's a lot more people to start with. Rather than being about 60 people, it's about maybe 200. And there is a general group examination process that is held. But after the group process, each individual veneerman is examined for about an hour. And so this can go on for days. And each side has 15 peremptory challenges and an unlimited number of challenges for cause in both cases.
Yeah, if you got an excuse, I don't count against your number.
Oh, if the veneer person simply cannot follow the law, then they are naturally removed from consideration as a juror. In a death penalty case, though, in any case, the prospective juror, the veneer person, has to agree to take an oath to follow the law. And in death penalty, one of the laws is the possibility of voting for death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you're going to serve on the panel, on the jury, you've got to agree that you would at least consider that in an appropriate case. Mm-hmm. And if you can't consider that in an appropriate case, then you are naturally going to have to be removed from consideration, as anybody would be. The other thing is that when the veneer men are being considered on a person-by-person basis, you've got to decide right then whether the juror, whether that person is acceptable or not acceptable. First of all, is there a legitimate challenge for cause? If there's a legitimate challenge for cause and the judge decides that, then that person's gone. But at that time, you've also got to decide, do you want to use one of your peremptory challenges if the person is not challengeable for cause? Now, in the non-death penalty case, the lawyers can use their peremptory challenges kind of in a comparative basis. Well, this person's bad, but this person's worse than that person. Yeah. So I'll get rid of the one that's the most bad for me and keep the least bad for me. But in a death penalty case, once you've made the decision, if you've used up your strike, that strike's gone. And unless the judge gives you some more strikes, you're pretty much out. Now, the challenges for cause in all cases, you've got an unlimited number of those. But the real difference is the primary difference, a major difference in the procedure is that one in death penalty cases, it takes a lot longer. The person that to be considered has to be death eligible or death qualified, because death is an issue in the case. And you've got to use your strikes if you use it, at that point, rather than waiting to see to compare two of the prospective jurors against each other.
And a detailed record is made of all of this for the appellate lawyers to examine.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be done. It should be done in every case. Every once in a while, I'll walk through a case through a court and see someone who didn't ask for a court reporter when they're picking a jury. But It happens, but clear down like a death penalty case, it's going to be done. But yeah, all proceedings are pretty much always recorded, and certainly a death penalty case.
Was there anything unique about this case?
Unique about this case from the
perspective of jury
selection. There are some unique things about this case, and I think Mike's going to talk about that more so, and that is the vacillating juror, because jurors say one thing when the judge is asking questions, then they say something different when the prosecutor is asking a question, and then say something totally different when the defense lawyer asks the question, and then the judge has to decide, is this an acceptable juror or not? If this juror subject to cause
some arguments at the bench.
And that is the fertile ground that the appellate lawyers would look at, particularly on this area of the vacillating juror.
Now, you're down there. Do you think most jurors try to be as honest in this process as possible, or do you think everybody's got whole cards in their purse?
Well, some do have whole cards. I mean, and that's the thing, that you have to try to find out which ones do. But by and large, they are trying, and especially in a non-death capital death penalty case, you don't get to talk to everybody on the panel, okay, on the veneer panel. So sometimes they can sit back and not say anything and hide, so you just don't know. Death penalty case, everybody gets talked to individually, and so whether they've got ulterior motives, It should be found out, and those who are being honest, even though they're trying, it becomes more difficult when you have judges and prosecuting attorneys and defense lawyers who are adept at sort of splitting hairs and asking questions just a little bit different to maybe get a result that's more to their favor, which they should do. And it does make it difficult for people who really aren't paying real close attention. And that's where sometimes the vacillating juror veneer person can occur. And Mike's going to talk about that.
Larry Douglas, criminal defense lawyer in practice in Houston, Harris County, and surrounding counties. And while Mike's coming up, I want to recall a personal incident. I I was waiting on a bus outside the jury assembly room, and there was this kind of elderly white lady with a walker standing there with her jury summons in her hand, waiting to get her free bus ride up Yale home. And I said, "How'd you do? Did you decide? Thank you for serving on the jury." She said, "I didn't make it. And I was so looking forward to convicting somebody today." And that's the attitude that you can encounter at a bus stop. Heaven forbid I'd encounter that in a courtroom. And so now we've got Mike Gillespie. Mike Gillespie is Susan Ashley is a practicing criminal defense lawyer. I forgot to say that. But everybody in this room that goes under the title lawyer actually tries cases. Hey, Mike, you're on. What's your piece of this puzzle?
Well, I'm going to follow up after Larry's talk. And Larry laid it out very well. The issue in picking the jury is getting people on there who is going to follow the law. Many times in picking a juror, jurors come up and say something that you might like or not like. And I'll give you a simple example. In this case, one of the jurors came up right up front and he said, "If he's here, there must be some reason he's here."
Okay.
That's not following the law.
That is not a presumption of innocence.
It's a presumption of innocence. And when somebody starts off by saying, "If he's here, there must be a reason for it," he cannot be a juror in this case. Now, I can strike him, but I get a limited amount of strikes. I'd rather the court strike him. The court would strike him based upon that. But what the court's going to do and the state's going to do is try to fix him up by making him say things like, "Well, even though that's your opinion, if the law says different, you will follow the law, won't you?" And the moment they said yes, that's when they get fixed.
He's
and
been
they can
tidied
be
up.
Exactly right. That was one example in this case. The other example in this case was another one of the jurors stated, and understand, in these cases, you have first trial on guilt or innocence, then second trial on the death penalty, which includes findings of future dangerousness. This juror said, if he did it, he's dangerous for always. He was not going to follow the law. He was going to put his own spin onto it. Well, that's a man that you want off the juror, mm-hmm. but you don't want to use a strike. But the state's going to fix him up. Let me give you another example.
And the arbiter of this is the judge.
Is the judge. And the trouble with this is it's very difficult to reverse the judge's opinion when he does not strike somebody. So the only person who can really strike the juror is the juror himself. The juror has to get up there and stand by his convictions. And let me give an example that was not in this case. But I have noticed something about pot smokers. Pot smokers love to come to court and have their day in court and yell about how they will find nobody guilty of smoking pot because pot should not be against the law. Then the state comes in and says, "Isn't it true you follow the law?" "Yes, I will." Well, what you do on that is you reward that man for standing up for his convictions. And when you talk to him, you make him feel that you have got a moral opinion based upon your life experiences that made you feel this way. You make him feel proud of having his own opinions. And you maybe put him in a situation where the court asks him, "Will he follow the law?" He will now reaffirm, "I've got a moral opinion. And my moral opinion is more than the law." That gets him off the jury panel. And that's what they're trying to do in this case. There were two jurors like that specifically that they tried to get off. But that's what a vacillating juror is. It's somebody who says something that you want him off, and the state tries to fix him so he's on, and you don't want to use one of your strikes. So you're trying to get the judge to strike him. But only he can get himself strike, and he's got to stay strong on what he said.
And he's not your client. You're not consulting him.
And so what you have to do is make him feel proud of standing up for his rights. And many people in court, this is their only time to stand up in a public forum and give an opinion that might be contrary to the law. And you need to reward him for that. Make him feel that you have got your own life experiences that makes moral judgments. You can express yourself. And if that gets him struck, that's what you're looking for.
Well, I mean, you hear sometimes that the judge is the person who instructs the jury on what is the law, and the jury applies the facts to the law. I mean, is that just gobbledygook?
That's true. Except when people have preconceived notions because, example, in this case, if you're on trial for murder, you must have done it. That is not following the law.
Yeah, it's a preconceived notion.
But that's somebody who's got a strong opinion.
Did they strike anybody from the jury?
I can't tell you that from the record. But I would assume there was a lot of strikes because death cab cases have a lot of jurors. There's two more issues that were brought up that were not really relevant. One of the issues he brought up is he thought, meaning the defendant, his lawyers, thought that there was an advantage to going first, that the first lawyer to talk to the juror had an advantage. And what the appellate court said is that might be true, that might not be true, but that wasn't developed as an issue right now, so they didn't address that issue. The second issue they tried to bring up was the issue that the jury was shuffled. And what a jury shuffle means is when the jurors come in, they go one to the end.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like the people in the first row, you can ask them to mix them all up to get a new shuffle to get different people in the first row.
And some of them may be worse people.
That's right, but that's the chance that you take. Shuffled.
How many times can a jury be shuffled?
The jury can be shuffled as much as the court thinks is necessary, but they're not going to do it often, probably once for each side. In this case, the court ruled that that was irrelevant argument because the people in the first row, there was no indication that it was racially motivated, that the jury was shuffled. So that was also a moot point.
And what's the importance of being people in the first row?
Well, the people in the first row are more likely to be picked than the people in the last row. Mm-hmm. You always have more jurors than necessary, enough to cover all the strikes.
When you get your 12 and alternatives, the rest of them are just home free.
Exactly right. And if nobody's struck, a lot are home free. And as they're struck, more comes to the front. If there's people in the front you don't like, you might want to shuffle to get them in the back. Most of these have got to do with race and what the courts felt where there was no race issues over here.
This is in Tyler, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Smith County. You ever tried a case in Smith County?
My accent keeps me out of East Texas.
Oh, okay, okay. Jim, you seem to have a pretty southern accent. You could practice law in Smith
I went
County.
Up there and they ran me out of town. I did some cases up in Texarkana, and I had to get a bondsman to get me out of town.
Oh, okay.
Because they were doing they do crazy stuff up there. It's just a different world. I want to follow up on something Mike talked about. What you normally do, you should know, and tell you how you do this. I'll give you a good example. We got a current case going on now. They're picking a jury in Boston at the current time on the guys that did the bombing.
Yeah.
Well, the judge has gotten a whole bunch of criticism for not granting a change of venue. Therefore, the judge wants to make certain to look good that they're going to qualify 12 people in Boston regardless, and they're going to be on the state side. And most of these capital cases, when it comes to picking a jury, the judge is real interested in getting a juror picked because he gets bored listening to all that stuff, and he's usually on the state side. Now, what will happen, the state will go first. And then what will happen if a jury vacillates back and forth in their decision, what you've got to do, if it's on your side, something for a good example of that, if somebody isn't certain they can answer all the questions correctly, and that's where you usually get a problem. And then you also have a problem, for example, on the guy in this particular case who didn't believe in the presumption of innocence, because here's what he said. Obviously, he was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he was indicted.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some reason for all that. He wouldn't be sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a juror like that, the state's going to try to rehabilitate him. You want him off the jury.
Yeah.
But you don't want to use a strike. So here's what you're going to do. The first thing you're going to do is kind of reinforce his idea and what you're saying. Looky, I understand what you're saying, and it makes a whole lot of sense to me. Because your experience, you know that from experience, from your own lifetime experience, that people who commit crimes are going to get indicted.
Here's the shovel, dig your hole deeper.
And you feel that way because of the way you feel and because of your character. And you're not going to change that opinion, are you? If this judge comes along and tells you that you have to follow the law, your character is going to override what that judge tells you, isn't he? So what you've got to do, you know ahead of time the judge is going to try to rehabilitate. That's the word that lawyers use. So what you do ahead of time, you try to weld him into his position by showing that he's taken this position because of his experience. He has real strong moral values, and no one's going to make him change his mind, judge or otherwise. Because what the judge will always do, if I tell you this is the law, will you follow the law? And everybody in East Texas, although they may be drinking moonshine whiskey, are going to say, I'm going to follow the law. They all say that.
Yeah.
So what you always do is weld them into a position and then tell them if the judge comes along and tells you.
You mean judge will let you get away with this?
Well, he has to. I've done it before. Sure,
okay.
He will. I mean, all you're doing is telling ahead of time what they're going to do.
Sure.
Because you take in this Boston case, this judge is going to do her dead level best to get a jury selected because she wants to be able to prove that she was correct in not granting a change of venue.
Okay. She's and got something on
right.
the line that
that's
she
exactly
has got to
right.
prove.
That's exactly right. And most of these judges that try capital cases, most of the times they bring in visiting judges. And visiting judges get, you know, they get pretty bored sitting up there listening to the same old thing over and over again. They want to get a jury and get on with killing somebody is what they want to do. And they're always going to be on the state side, and they're going to always try to rehabilitate people because they want to get the trial over with. And that's the problem you always face as a defense lawyer.
Yeah. Well,
and one thing I want to mention, we've talked about this before. A lot of people in the death penalty movement think it's wonderful that we have fewer death penalty cases now. What they're doing, and this is, I think, horrible, and people are not aware of it, aware of the consequences. They've now permitted our jurors to assess life without parole, which is, in fact, a death sentence. Now,
yeah.
Here's what's bad about that. In a capital case where they're seeking the death penalty, the two big areas of reversible error are jury voir dire and punishment hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this particular case, there's no question about guilt or innocence. DNA evidence, fingerprints, items that were taken from the place he had, pawned them, sold them to. No question about guilt or innocence. The only area you look at is voir dire. The jury selection, you look at the punishment part of it. Did the lawyer do his job in presenting mitigating evidence? If the state seeks a capital case and waives the death penalty, guess what? The jury voir dire and death penalty case is not applicable. They pick a jury within about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that fertile ground of reversible error is destroyed and eliminated. And then what happens? There's no punishment hearing. Period. When you're found guilty of a non-capital case, you're automatically assessed a life sentence without a punishment hearing. Now, in a regular death penalty case, you can present mitigating evidence to show why the guy shouldn't get the death sentence. Well, a life without parole is, in fact, a death sentence, but you cannot present mitigating evidence of the person's background like you can in death penalty cases. It's a road straight in. It's what makes it even worse. And people haven't talked about this. When they go to TDC, how are they going to control people who have no hope of ever getting out? You know how they're going to control them? They're going to put them all in isolation. Because if I go to prison and I know there's no chance of me getting out except through suicide or death, I'll break every rule I want to. What can they do to me? Can't do anything to me. And I'm going to be pretty much out of control. And how do you take care of someone like that if you don't have a carrot to dangle in front of their head?
Well, Jim, my instinct is to see the logic in what you're saying. But I remember Jerry Burdine,
mm-hmm.
who was on death row for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And he got commuted to life in prison. And he wrote me and he said, "Thank God they didn't cut me loose. I couldn't handle that kind of freedom. This is all the freedom I can handle." Now, that is counterintuitive. And the other one I think of is Henry Lee Lucas.
Okay, but if Jerry Burdine was facing life without parole, would he be that nice in general population if he didn't have any hope of getting out?
I don't know. I've never been. I went with 160 years. I was pretty much life without parole.
Yeah, but Ray, you and I both know back in those days that they paroled people out. You had a chance of getting out. If I don't have a chance of getting out, I'm going to be real difficult to control.
Well, I got out a lot quicker than Johnny Holmes was happy with. That's for damn sure.
And probably a lot of other people, too. But all I'm saying is a lot of prison officials do not like life without parole because they have no control over
anybody. We got plenty of time here. And what we're waiting for is Pat to notify Elizabeth that the chickens have crossed the road going the other direction and the procedure is over. We do know that when the witnesses cross the road, that the procedure will begin. What we fear these days is things like in Oklahoma and Arizona, where the drugs don't work so well, and somebody lays there and suffers. I think the last Oklahoma case, they suffered for 4 hours struggling, trying to die. And finally, they decided they were going to call the whole thing off. And at that point, the struggle had reached the point that the person being executed died of a heart attack, not necessarily related to the chemistry that is being pumped into his body. It is so easy in this. We don't know what they're giving them. What do you think about that?
Well, first off, the problem is, if you recall, the last execution that we had here in Texas took, what, 20 minutes?
20 minutes, that's pretty standard.
And because the last one we had, you know, the witness went across the road, and at 6:20, he was pronounced dead, so it was pretty quick. So we haven't had that same. We've had only had one problem, maybe two cases, where it took an extended period to die.
Well, and we found out later that that problem was a matter of finding a vein.
Finding a vein, right.
And it wasn't related to the chemistry working or not working. But we didn't know that when we were
right
on the air.
But we didn't have a comparable case like they had in Arizona or in Oklahoma.
No, we haven't had that. But
the only Okies could mess up an execution.
Well, I'm not entirely sure. Texas could go pretty long way, you know. I mean, if they turned this over to Dan Patrick, good Lord.
I'm afraid they have, right? I hate to tell you.
Let me tell you, the state of Texas politics, especially when it comes to the very serious issue, I have to inform this audience that I had a lot better things to do tonight than come in here and do this radio show. I do not love doing this radio show. I don't think any of us do. But we do it because we think there is a journalistic responsibility to cover these things accurately in an acute way and hopefully educate the listening audience to this. Because you folks that are listening right now are not the only people that will hear this show. We'll be in the archives forever, and you can listen to every show we've ever done by going to executionwatch.org, which is our website. And everything we do goes onto that website. This will be on the website before morning, and you'll be able to get this tomorrow.
And when I complain about Otis, that's going to be there forever and eternity.
That's right.
Okay.
You write that down.
Unless I edit it.
Otis said, unless he edits it, which he probably will, knowing Otis.
And
by the way, that's our wonderful engineer I'm always feuding with.
Otis is really more than an engineer. He's the guy that keeps our archive working and all of that.
Oh.
Yeah, he's the guy that keeps all of this. And let me tell you, I am honored to be able to work with the people that are in this room. Elizabeth makes it so easy for me, although I think on a day-to-day basis, she just thinks I'm a pain in the butt because I ask strange things and fuss at her and all of that. But the fact of the matter is, this show, in terms of being radio, is done right. And it's done as a form of the media that is up to the task at hand. And the task at hand is the very serious business of a state killing its citizens. Some for very little reason and frequently erroneously. There's some people in line to be killed. Lester, who I will interview next Wednesday, is the dean. He's been there longer than everybody else. Has got 999 number. But Lester just has three numbers. He was on there before they got the 999 designation, and he's been there longer than anybody else. And I will go up and interview Lester. Now, there's a very good chance that even though Lester's been there longer than anybody else, his case, I am told, is entirely circumstantial. There's not any tangible evidence connecting him with this homicide, and it's been a long time ago, and this is not his first date come around, but it's his first date in recent times. I've got to thank some folks here. I want to thank Pat Hartwell. Bless her heart, she drove all the way to Huntsville up there, and she's sitting there dutifully watching the road to see if the witnesses cross. I appreciate her good effort. I want to thank Dave Atwood, who is heading up the demonstration here in Houston. Those are our two off-site reporters. We have five lawyers that work on this case. Jim Skelton is the kind of the wizard that conducts everything, and you wouldn't believe how much paperwork Jim can generate per each case. And then Susan covers part of it, Larry covers part of it, Michael and Jack do. That's Susan Ashley, practicing criminal defense lawyer. Larry Douglas, practicing criminal defense lawyer. Michael Gillespie, practicing criminal defense lawyer, but not in East Texas. And Jack Lee, who is a practicing attorney who can just about go anywhere and get away with it. And I want to thank all the lawyers for doing that. Elizabeth is wonderful. Otis manages to keep the whole thing together so it works. I want to thank Michael Woodson, who frequently gives us his time so we can do the show, but we're in fundraising, so we're here. And so my name is Ray Hill, and I have been the host since the beginning of this. I presume that Robert Ladd is now dead. Elizabeth just came back, and she didn't shake her head one way or the other. The witnesses have not crossed the road. We will read about that sometime between now and midnight when Michael Grazik puts his story in the Houston Chronicle. Tell your friends. They're killing people in Texas. And the next person they have scheduled to kill is Donald Newberry. And he's scheduled to be executed on the 4th. We hope that does not happen. But if it does, we'll be in the main studio and on broadcast. The only thing wrong with there being an HD channel is people on death row can't hear our show. And they treasure it so. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends.